Free version. And yeah, they have all these scenes. It is. I mean, look at it.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Thank you all for coming this early and very chilly morning. We'll have some announcements a bit later on other things that are going on during the next couple of days, but because we're a couple minutes late, I think we should go ahead and get started on our agenda. Paul?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, welcome back to the Capitol.
So happy to be here.
The first item on the agenda is on the update for a study that the 13 legislature assigned to us on a clean air fee or tax in Oregon from Senate Bill 306. We have several things in OLIS for you on that. The first that I wanted to go through very quickly with you is entitled Senate Bill 306, Feasibility of Clean Air Tax or Fee in Oregon. It's just kind of a process outline. And you can see what it looks like here. This is just kind of an outline of reminding you what you did in 13 and kind of where we're at in the project. The Senate Bill 306 assigned the Legislative Revenue Office required us to issue a report to the interim committees and with a final due date of November of 2014, but a preliminary report by December 1 of 13. We were appropriated $200,000 to carry out this study. What we've done a number of things. First is we issued a RFP, and we got two proposals. We selected the Northwest Economic Research Center, NERC, who had talked to the committee during the regular session about some work they had done in this area. We enlisted the aid of the six state agencies. We formed what's called a Technical Advisory Committee, or TAC, and we've had a lot of cooperation from the agencies, particularly Department of Energy, Department of Environmental Quality have been very helpful in giving us feedback, and they helped us review those proposals and make the selection of NERC as the contractor. We've also used some of the dollars that were appropriated to us to hire what I'm referring to as a quality assurance person, but he's a person very familiar with regional modeling, used to work for us, Ed Waters, and so he's going to help us evaluate, help us keep on track and work with the folks at NERC to make sure our regional modeling is consistent with standards and we're getting at the questions we're trying to address. You can see the project outline there on that sheet. It's most you're kind of about halfway through that now, and we're at the point of preparation of a draft project outline and to review with you during legislative days. Our intent would be to go through that with you, get feedback. We've got an informal work group of four members that is helping us review it. Representative Bailey's on that group. Representative Benz is as well. To go through that with us and give us some direction if there's a sense that we're not carrying out the requirements of 306. But anyway, so Mazin is the project manager for us. So I'll ask Mazin to come up. And then we have Jeff Renfro and Jenny Liu from the Northwest Economic Research Center that I can go through the draft outline with you.
Great. Should they come up now?
Yeah. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee, Mazin Malik with Legislative Revenue Office, and here acting as the project manager on this means that I have to pretend I know about carbon tax. I think Paul have mentioned everything that we have been going through with the process and how we envision this thing by enlisting some of our experts around the state, and this time I would like to, if you have any questions, I'll be here to answer them. I don't have more to add except to give them the floor and allow them to go through the outline of what they would like to do in the study.
Please.
Chair Barnhart. Representatives, faculty. So my name is Jenny Liu, a faculty member of the School of Urban Studies and Planning, and I'll be going through the outline today. So you should have the outline document in front of you, which will include the report outline as well as the general requirements that we intend to fulfill for the report. So in our presentation today, I'll go through some of the point out a couple of the features of the report on our slides here. So, one of the main report features will be to identify an effective administrative structure, and what we mean by this administrative structure would be a structure that ensures that there is economic efficiency and that we try to price the clean air fee or tax at a price that would be appropriate to reach that efficiency, and also a price that would be effective in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions to fulfill some of the goals of the state to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions to 90% of 1990 levels by 2030, as well as also considering the cost effectiveness of administration to make sure that we're not placing an undue burden on the administration of the particular kind of fee or tax that we are we're going to look at for this report. So in addition to that, one thing that we're going to pay particular attention to is to evaluate what are the economic impacts on low-income households, but not only to low-income households, but also to pretty much across all income levels across the state in at least five different income categories or more. We're also going to take a look at the impacts across geographic regions. So, so we've divided up the Oregon geography into six separate regions. So you'll see on here, there is the Portland metropolitan area. There's the Willamette Valley area, the North Coast, the South Coast, Central Oregon, as well as Eastern Oregon. And these are the geographic regions we're going to pay particular attention to compare between what are the economic impacts and how they're distributed across the geographic regions, as well as for across income levels for households. So I'll turn the floor over to Jeff to talk a little bit about the several industry sectors.
And I'm Jeff Renfro with the Northwest Economic Research Center. So we presented the results of an earlier study that we did, and we had to use a pretty high level of aggregation, and we just presented results for the state as a whole. So for this this expanded version, we need to look at the impacts that as they vary by geographic area, but then also we want to get a better sense of which industries are affected. So we're going to use a 70-industry sectoring scheme. So each industry in Oregon will fall into one of those 70 sectors. SB 306 also directed us to work with Business Oregon to make sure that we paid a particular attention to some of their targeted industries. So you can see we're going to focus on outdoor gear and activewear, high technology, forestry and wood products, advanced manufacturing, and clean tech. That will be part of the regular analysis, but the report will pay particular attention to those industries. Just on our own, we also plan on highlighting the effect on agriculture, transportation, state and local government, and other manufacturing sectors. And then we'll also just go through, and if there's anything surprising or anything noteworthy, we'll also.
Pardon me, but back me up just a little bit. The study you're doing is on the possibility of a tax on emissions or carbon producing, or what exactly? And how does it relate to outdoor gear and activewear? You've lost me somewhere between taxing carbon and outdoor gear and activewear, so would you tie those strings together for me?
And if you're planning to do that later on in the presentation, that would be fine, too.
Yeah.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Berger. So the relationship here is that we're looking at a clean air tax or fee on greenhouse gas emissions, or CO2 in general, and how it ties into these key industries identified by Business Oregon is that these are some of the key traded sectors that employ a lot of people here in Oregon. So we want to pay particular attention to, if we put a price on carbon emissions, how it would affect these specific sectors. sectors, and would it affect their employment? Would it affect their output? Would it affect their technology? So these were the sectors that were identified by Business Oregon to say that these are the main employment sectors that we want to pay attention to.
Yeah, please.
So if I could, the scope of this project then appears to me that if we want to put a tax on carbon, then we want to be sure not to hurt our existing industries or the poor, previous slide.
Mm-hmm.
Did you give, also includes agriculture, transportation, state and local government, other manufacturing sector, transportation being the big carbon piece, okay, which is just sort of slipped in there. Did you also look geographically at where the carbon's coming from and look at a scheme that would, therefore, if you came from an area that was producing a lot of carbon, are you looking at making those people pay more?
Representative Berger, Chair Barnhart, this we will talk a little bit more about this in a following slide, but to really quickly answer that is that we are putting a pretty much a uniform fee or tax on carbon, but we will also talk about what are the options of repatriating or giving back that revenue back to the several industries that to make the economy more or less not harming the economy here in Oregon. So those are several options that we're going to explore.
Thank you. I just needed those things tied together a little better. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Sure.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
So very briefly, the way we intend to do this is we're going to stitch together a few different models. So we're going to start with a tool called CTAM. We used CTAM earlier. We're going to use it in a different way this time. So basically, we're going to have a dynamically generated energy usage model for Oregon. Included in that forecast is going to be a forecast of prices, not just usage. So we're going to take the forecasted prices out of our model, and we're going to put that into an input-output model called REMI. So the centerpiece of this study is going to be basically modeling what's going to happen to different industries in different geographic areas when we increase their energy price. Also related to that, we're going to model the effect of taking that revenue and then distributing it back to the economy in different ways to find kind of not the optimal way, but to figure out what the dynamics are, what the trade-offs are between different repatriation scenarios. We have two physicists from Portland State University who aren't here today, but they're on our project team. So they're going to take the results of our economic impact analysis, and they're going to come up with dynamically generated emissions reduction estimates. We're going to use those emissions reduction estimates to generate revenue estimates for the state. So a pretty significant improvement on what we've done before is every piece of this is dynamic. It's all reacting to itself. So we should have a more accurate sense of how this is going to affect the state. We're going to look at methods for treating imported and exported energy. Our original report was modeled after the British Columbia carbon tax. We're still using that tax as kind of a basic starting point or a basic framework to work with. They do not have a tax on imported energy, and they don't tax exported energy. So we're going to investigate if we did institute a tax like that, what are the practical consequences of that, and then what are the economic impacts of taxing or not taxing. In addition, as I said, we're going to report our results with a variety of scenarios. So we assume that in order to have a positive economic impact, a lot of the revenue will need to be repatriated through the form of tax cuts. We're also going to investigate if you keep some of that revenue aside and you target it to specific reinvestment options or target it to specific industry assistance programs, if that can have a more positive impact on the state. We're going to present the result of a variety of scenarios to give policymakers a better sense, like I said, of kind of the trade-offs here.
Yes, Representative Berger.
And included in that will be any discussion of what industries might not come because of this tax, might not consider Oregon because of this tax?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger. Included in this, we're going to look at that in two different ways. So just basically, if energy prices are higher here in Oregon, and so some industries, the increase in energy prices is not going to be offset by a decrease in their tax payments. So we'll forecast the viability of these industries into the future. So we would see a lack of growth in that industry, which would reflect both a decrease in new investment, but then also a decrease in existing activity. We're also going to look at, yes?
Yep. And how far in the future do you go? For instance, 10 years ago, if someone had said server farms are going to grow in Oregon, I would have said, what's a server farm? So it's really hard to go forward and say, what is an industry that wouldn't come here because of, do you see what I'm suggesting?
Yes, Representative Berger. So to partly get at that, we're going to also look at how energy prices affect new technology adoption. So we're not going to be able to predict what technology is going to be invented between now and 10 years from now, obviously. But we will be able to look at how quickly Oregon industries will move to new technologies, whatever those technologies may be.
Thank you. And thank you for thinking of that.
My pleasure.
All right, so also, as defined in Senate Bill 306, we are also going to take a look on the background of existing environmental laws and regulations that may have to do with carbon emissions and other related issues. We're going to take a look at the background on the costs and benefits. We're not going to specifically analyze each of these as something that might be replaced by a carbon tax, but we'll definitely do a comparison between these various statutes and the carbon tax. And finally, just to go back to revenue repatriation a little bit more, the design of the revenue of repatriation, or where the revenue will go back to, is also defined in the Senate Bill 306, is to maximize the positive economic impacts or to neutralize any of the negative economic impacts, but also to mitigate the negative impacts on the various groups or regions that might be hurt most by something like a clean air fee or tax. So these will be probably the low-income households, different geographic regions, urban versus rural, as well as different industry sectors in the economy. So that concludes our presentation.
Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. My understanding is that in the outline in that section on administrative structure, you will be looking at the impact of potential carbon prices on the overall carbon emissions level in the state of Oregon. Is that correct?
Representative Bailey, that's correct.
And as follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
As part of that investigation, will you be looking at the at least theoretical relationship between the price of carbon and the true cost of carbon, or is that outside the scope of your analysis?
Representative Bailey, that we will be looking at the true cost of carbon as part of our background and literature review to see how those match up with the actual pricing that we might implement here in Oregon. So, yes.
And true cost has to do with the effects of carbon dioxide on the atmosphere and on the weather and all those other things, as well as the cost of mining and distribution of fossil fuels and other things of that sort. Have I got that right?
Yes.
The total cost rather than simply the cost that currently is in the price.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We will look at the social cost of carbon, which is includes an entire field of research that looks at all of the costs into the future of carbon emissions on the earth, on industries, on weather, on losses in agriculture, and et cetera.
Yeah, Representative Bailey. Representative Davis.
It's okay. It's been a few weeks.
It's been a few weeks. And I often mix up people's names, but I apologize.
I consider it a compliment.
And I'll always apologize for that, but I'll continue doing it, too.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Davis, please.
I don't see anywhere, thank you for your testimony, first of all, in the presentation. I don't see anywhere in the bill where it requires the study or the implementation to be revenue neutral. For example, the BC project, there was that requirement. Can you talk about, are you going to be throwing out different scenarios in terms of revenue neutrality? Are you going to be talking about a cut, overall increase? How does that piece work?
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis. So a few of our scenarios are will be just revenue neutral, and within a revenue neutral repatriation system, you can allocate different amounts of the revenue to different tax cuts. So we're going to look at a few just straight revenue neutral with different allocation methods. But then we also do want to look at setting aside some of that money. From our perspective, a reason to do that is we assume that that is a possibility in the future, and we want to at least demonstrate kind of the trade-offs between potentially efficiency and targeted economic benefit. So we consider that to be just part of a potential options for the future, and we want to give people information they can use to make those decisions.
I really appreciate the work that you're doing on this process, and I have to tell you that when Dr. Patowski came to and made a presentation on the Senate side in one of our conference rooms during the last session, I was astounded by the assertion that a properly established carbon tax and a properly distributed system of distributing the revenue, properly set up system of distributing the revenue, might actually lead to economic growth beyond what would otherwise exist. I'm assuming that among the things you're studying, you're looking at that possibility as well. And of course, as somebody who's very concerned about carbon emissions, the idea that our economy can actually be made more efficient, more effective, generate more jobs by appropriately pricing carbon and using the money in a way that promotes economic development and protection of low-income people and all those other things you've already mentioned, we could start a cascade effect and actually get at some of the climate change issues that are probably extremely dangerous for the world in the future. I mean, I know that's a huge lift for a little state like Oregon, but we're talking basically about a long-term demonstration project based on the predictive work that you're able to do. Now, am I even close in what the purpose of this project is? And if not, would you describe it more clearly for us?
Chair Barnhart. Yeah, I would say from that is close to kind of our intent is to give you the information to effectively implement whatever it is that the legislative body decides to do. But yeah, when we were investigating the issue of carbon pricing, when we looked around at carbon pricing schemes around the world, we focused on the British Columbia scheme, mainly because they had successfully reduced emissions, and more study needs to be done on kind of the dynamics of the effect of the tax in British Columbia, but it is safe to say that they've had modest economic growth that's above the rest of Canada at the same time that they've significantly reduced their emissions. So I think your description is accurate.
Thank you. Any other questions for this? Madison, did you want to add?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll add a thing and also a recap of the project just to go back to the intent. As in Senate Bill 306, I think basically started at a certain point to answer the question of how would the atmosphere and the economic environment in Oregon would react if the tax that we know today moves to a carbon tax, and therefore simulate all these issues and how it impacts the main industries that we have. And that's why the bill specify that Business Oregon is the entity that identifies those industries and say these are the industries that need to be examined, whether they would be hurt, excel, or so on. Now, of course, there is no way of knowing whether new industries will be coming, but assuming that if these industries are flourishing, the ones that we have today, we are probably in the clustering business, and therefore we will be attacking the same type of industry, innovative industries, and so on. So that's the assumption. However, there is also the idea, if you would see in the Senate bill, that we have a whole host of policies within the statutes about carbon and emissions and reductions and energy and so on. And you would see this in the bottom of the bill, in Section J, assuming that there is all these statutes that we have today, and these are supposed to increase or encourage or discourage certain things. And the intent was to see how the interaction between the tax on carbon and those new types or, you know, these policies would react. So I think the idea is the intent with the bill was to direct the legislative revenue officer to basically give the a whole bunch of type options, and the options will come back to you and say, under these options and under these assumptions, what can we expect realistically to start implementing that. And I think that's all these questions are part of the discussion that we are trying to get NERCs to NERC, not only not the NERCs but that I guess the thing that we're trying to put in front of you today.
Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony. Good luck with the research. Be prepared to answer tough questions like the ones Representative Berger asked. You've done well so far, I think, on answering her questions. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just say one thing about kind of where what we plan to do going forward. The intent of the draft outline was to get some feedback. So any feedback you have for us, we very much appreciate. So we have set December 15th to come back with what we call a final draft. And so based on that feedback, we'll have something, and then we'll send that out on December 15th. And then we will begin doing the nuts and bolts that Jenny and Jeff have outlined. So we plan to meet with them monthly and have our agency review group work with us. And we will be giving you periodic updates to the committee. This afternoon, we're going to go through this briefing with the Senate Environmental Committee
at 2
o'clock. So the bill says once we are to submit the report to the Revenue Environmental Committee. So we'll try to keep both of those committees, or all four of those committees, really updated.
Great.
I just want to comment. Thank you very much. I guess I wanted to put on the record that I'm pretty skeptical about this, and so you know going in the kinds of questions that the public will be asking us. It is not in any way to diminish the research that you're engaged in and its importance and how much I appreciate that you're doing it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul, our next.
I'll have S. Day to come up.
Day. Yes, sir. School distribution formula.
Yes, sir. Morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. House Bill 2506 of the 2013 legislature created the Task Force on School Funding and charged it with making possible recommendations as to state school fund distribution formula. The task force had the first meeting a week ago and elected the chair and the vice chair. And Mr. Brian Reeder from the Education Department is here to brief the committee.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Research at the Department of Education. Just wanted to give you a brief report on the first meeting of the School Funding Task Force that was put in place by House Bill 2506. The charge in the bill to the task force, really the key charge, was that the task force shall make recommendations regarding possible modifications to the funding formulas used to distribute state school fund monies to school districts and education service districts. So it really is getting at the heart of our school funding formula and whether or not changes are needed to the formula to meet sort of the goals of the formula as we might see them today, to the extent that they may differ from how we saw them back when the formula was initially put in place. As Day said, the task force met on November 12th, and at that meeting I presented the outline that you see up on the screen as a place to start the discussion about evaluating the funding formula. Also at that meeting, we had presentations from Michael Elliott, who is a colleague at the Department of Education, who works directly with the funding formula today in making the distributions to school districts and ESDs. He provided an overview of how the formula works today. And then we had some history from Jim Scherzinger, who is a former legislative revenue officer, maybe understands Oregon's formula better than anyone. And also Ozzie Rose, who has worked with school issues, school funding for many, many years. So really a very good presentation about how the formula came into being in Oregon and the modifications that have happened over time. At the meeting, we discussed, back up a little bit. We initially elected a chair and a vice chair for the task force. The chair is Senator Devlin, and the vice chair is Representative Comp. And we also adopted rules for the task force. And then talked really about the development of a work plan for the task force. And unanimously, the task force felt that this outline that we initially talked about was represented a good starting point for developing a work plan. And so the assignment given to the task force was to come back at our second meeting, which is tentatively planned for December 9th, with any modifications to this outline that they feel would be important to include as part of a work plan. Some of the things that came up at the initial meeting that fall into that category are how economies of scale affect the cost structure of school districts and individual schools. We know that in Oregon we have a lot of small school districts and a lot of small schools. We currently have a couple of provisions in our funding system that provide additional resources to those, what we call the small school correction for both elementary and secondary schools, and also the small high school grant, which provides additional resources to small districts with small high schools. Another issue raised was whether the formula might need special weights for Native American students or other categories of students that historically have underperformed in our schools. We currently weight certain characteristics of students, but ethnicity and racial background are not among them. We discussed the earmarking of the dollars that are associated with particular weights, in other words, requiring districts to spend the money attributed to a given weight on the students which generated those weights. And then another one, which we discussed at some length, which is actually is on this outline near the end, or at, really at the very end, is a recent issue that has come up with students who are staying in high school for a fifth year and actually attending community college during that fifth year. The issue there is that those students are still eligible for funding through our K-12 funding formula, even though they are pretty much full-time college students. Not something that was not intended by the formula, but which current law doesn't prohibit. It's an interesting discussion because there are certain benefits associated with that activity, but there are also certain costs and a certain draw on the state school fund that wasn't initially intended. So it's a key issue that the task force wanted to discuss. I guess the last point I'll make is that the task force has roughly 11 more months or 10 and a half more months to do its work. The report is due to the legislature on October 1st of 2014. We anticipate that the task force will meet once a month, roughly, maybe more often if we need to near the end, but also agreed that a fair amount of the work can be done via email in terms of getting information to task force members, exchanging ideas, having discussions, understanding that these are public meetings, and so only certain things can be done via email, and other things must be done at the meetings. So with that, I'll just open it up to questions.
Yes, Representative Belzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the discussions of the different types of weights, I know that one of the suggestions that was submitted to the department were kids that have really significant behavioral needs that have a high need for a larger number of support staff in a classroom that may not be kids in poverty, they may not be special ed. Has there been a discussion about how we might better finance those programs to keep those kids and staff safe and help them graduate from high school?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelser, the task force didn't discuss that at the initial meeting. We did discuss, however, the idea that within the special ed community, students on IEPs, that perhaps different types of IEPs might require different weights. So that may fit sort of generally under that concept of identifying students with different needs at different levels of weights, but not specifically that issue.
And just briefly to follow up, I think the important distinction here is many of these kids aren't special ed eligible, but they probably are much more expensive to support than a medically fragile child, for instance, that we might think of when we look at as a student whose needs are pretty expensive. And if we are looking at 40-40-20, these are the same kids that are getting sent out to alternative schools, to prisons, to the Oregon Youth Authority. And if we just look at it within special ed, we're not going to pick them up. And it's both a graduation issue and it's a workforce issue in terms of safety of staff within our school buildings as well.
Absolutely. Representative Barnhart, Representative Gelser, sort of as a general principle, I think you'll note this if you look at the outline and read it carefully, that the proposal for the task force is to initially come to an agreement on sort of what we mean by equity and how a funding formula achieves that. And one of the principles, one of the key principles of equity, and I believe Oregon's formula currently adheres to this principle, is that different students with different characteristics have different costs to educate to a given desired level of achievement or performance, including behavioral factors and sort of performance in a broad sense. And so it is the intent of an equity formula to take into account cost differences when it distributes resources to school districts. So to the extent that costs to educate kids differ, then the funding formula would take those into account in distributing those funds. Now, clearly we can't take into account every cost difference that exists in the world out there. That would make a funding formula just unmanageable. But clearly the major cost differences that influence districts' ability to get kids to an education level that is desirable are the ones that are most important to put in a formula.
Thank you,
Representative Berger.
Brian, I don't think we're going to get there in this study, but one of the things that has always bothered me about our formula, which is supposed to be a distribution formula, is that the way we use weights in some ways locks us into some places where I'm always uncomfortable. Witness the poverty issue. Poverty's moved, but the weights stayed there. And time meant that the formula, the weighting, became wacko. Do you understand what I'm saying here? And now we have to kind of make a readjustment. I'm looking at Ozzy back there laughing. But that is, I think, a function of the fact that we use weights. So I would really feel better if you had some discussion of what if we took the formula and said a student is a student and a certain percentage goes out just based on the students. Take the weights out of the formula and then looked at some other scheme for accounting for the things that the weights talk about, English as a second language, disabilities, the transportation, whatever, small school, whatever those things that we wait for. Maybe there's another mechanism besides weight that would be better in, as a formula. Do you understand? So if we took 50% of the distribution and distributed it on a per-student basis, assuming a student is a student is a student, and then took the rest of the 50% and said, then how could we distribute the rest of it according to the needs of the students in that district, be they be transportation? I mean, knowing that there's a limit to the fund. And if you would just have a discussion about that, I'd feel better. Because we're going to end up with weights again, and I've always been bothered by the weights driving sort of a mindset. Because at the bottom of the heap, a student is a student is a student, and they all have needs. And they all need a good education. And the weight turns a student into something else. And this bothers me. So I'm just asking that you put this into your mind and thinking that there may be a better way of skinning this cat, although I don't think we're going to get there in one study group.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, I would argue that the current formula does almost exactly what you just described. You mentioned sending out, say, 50% of the money just on the basis that a student is a student is a student. Well, that's what the first weight does right now. Right now, the first weight that every student gets just by being a student represents about 536,000 of the 660,000 total weights we have out there. So it's even more than 50%. And then the other weights are the mechanism that we adjust for, that we use to adjust for those exceptional costs that are based on student characteristics. Now, we could do that part using some other mechanism other than weights, and I anticipate that this task force will consider that.
That's all I'm asking.
And so, absolutely, we will do that. But I want to be clear that the formula only distributes about, you know, whatever that is, less than a third of the total money based on the extra weights, and two-thirds go out based on just a student is a student is a student.
And Mr. Chair, Brian, I don't want to argue with you on this. You're absolutely right, but the weights themselves become a weight on the formula, and they're inflexible in some sense. Whereas what I'm suggesting is take that first bite and distribute, and then find another way besides weights to reach the needs of the students. And I don't know what that would be. I'm just asking you, we designed this system, and so we're kind of married to it. And I guess I just would like to think about, is there a better system out there at this point? I don't think this task force has the resources or the time to actually blow the lid off and devise a new system. So you're going to go back to some kind of weights. And I appreciate that you, who knows this more than just about anyone in the state, understands that at some level the weights do, a student is a student is a student. But then we start adding these weights, and every time we do that, you embedded in it is a policy sort of a manipulation that I think as our student population changes and our it sort of drives thinking, and it isn't student-directed in as much as Representative Gelser, who's over there nodding at me, and I would like in the ideal. I just don't know that we can get here, but I just would like the discussion at your level, and that's all I'm asking. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I would just I really agree with what Representative Berger is talking about. I think if you go and you look at the weights around special ed, for instance, if a district is under 11% because they know they can get up to 11%, they aggressively work to identify students so they can get that full 11%, so they get 11%. If they're over 11%, that's a detriment to students because students that need extra services, it's much harder for them to get their evaluations and identification because the district is at their 11%. If we're capping at 11%, and everybody's trying to get to that number, why not get rid of all that work and just allocate that money? You also talked about, you know, whether or not the weighted dollars should be actually tagged to the services that are there. We've seen that across the state in English language learners, where the district gets that additional weight because they have those English language learners, but if you go and audit the district, those dollars aren't actually going to English language learner services. So does it make more sense, rather than tying it to the weight, to distribute it in a different way that is accountable for the outcomes for those kids? So I do think that it comes back to a weight, but it changes the way that we think about things. And then finally, I agree with Representative Berger. I think it's a great conversation to have, but anytime you look at changing the formula, there are going to be winners and losers. So the idea of moving something through the building and changing the law when some districts that are represented by members are going to get more money as a result of it, and others are going to see significantly less, cobbling together a majority for that change, I think will be a fascinating challenge and process.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelser, the situation you described with the 11% cap, I think, is a clear example of not necessarily of a system that uses weights, but a system that has incentives in it to over-identify. And other systems have those same incentives, not just a weighted system. And so that's the key issue. And there are ways to overcome that reduce that incentive to over-identify, or even eliminate that incentive to over-identify. We have the same situation with our transportation formula. By reimbursing spending, you're providing virtually no incentive for them to try and find efficiencies, because they don't pay very much of that themselves, or at least that's the perception. So clearly there are two issues, and I think you'll find this in the outline as well, although maybe not developed quite as well, is that a key issue of any funding formula is what are the incentives that it creates for districts that may lead to unintended consequences. Clearly, we have some of those now. Other formulas will have them as well. And so you're absolutely right. This is a discussion that needs to be had, and I think this task force will have that discussion. But again, whether it's a weighted formula or any other formula with a fixed pot of money, any changes will have winners and losers. You know, even a situation of improving your data will have winners and losers without even changing the weights or the formula. So, you know, if being locked into a formula because there might be losers from a change is a difficult place to be. but clearly the task force will address those questions.
That's really useful. I think that when we set up this task force, we were hoping that we were going to be able to improve the outcomes that we get in the public schools with the dollars we have. And, of course, many of us view, and I think maybe most of us view, that the dollars we have aren't enough, but we should use the ones we have in the most effective way possible. One additional comment I'd like to make that I haven't heard yet this morning is that there may be other incentives that ought to be looked at in addition to the ones you've already indicated. One of them, which I think is fairly egregious, incentive has to do with the use of new technology, new innovations that actually reduce the cost of expenditures on students because of the nature of those expenditures. And I haven't been able to tease out all the information on that yet, but I hope that you will do some work on that. For example, in the Springfield School District, they have contracts with some of the vendors who do online classes, and the cost of those online classes, recognizing that an online class doesn't give you everything that a class in school with other students with a teacher in front of you gives you, but those online classes typically cost somewhere between 40% and 60% of the cost of a class done in the school building. So I'm hoping, and of course what that means is that there is a built-in incentive to use more of them. I hope that the task force will be considering that issue as well. Right now the number of online schools or online classes we have is relatively small. There are appropriate places to use them. There are students who need them, and there are subjects which you couldn't possibly teach if you didn't use them. But on the other hand, we don't want to get into the box where students are encouraged to take an online class because it saves the district money.
Chair Barnhart, I agree with that completely. You know, in our current system where, you know, we essentially provide a lump sum of dollars to the school district with little or no strings attached to how they spend it, that sort of in a general way provides them with an incentive to reduce their costs, to look for ways to do things more cheaply. However, we don't want that to be at the expense of students getting a less comprehensive or a poorer quality education. And so I think a key piece in any of this is an accountability system that holds districts accountable for the performance of their students. Now, it's very hard to design a funding formula that has in sort of accountability features in it for actual student performance. And so a system that, and I don't know that we've stumbled onto the right one yet, but a mechanism to hold districts accountable for their student success is really an essential companion to the funding formula. And, you know, I think the vision, the initial formula was that don't attach strings because we don't want to limit or tie the hands of school districts, and we have so much diversity around the state in student needs and district size and so forth that trying to devise a scheme of earmarks that would be appropriate for every district would be, you know, almost impossible. So the freedom to use the money as they see fit and that best suits their circumstances, but accompanied by some strict requirements on how well their students do, is sort of the vision that I think is where we stand right now. Understanding that our accountability system is sort of in its infancy and may not be the be-all and end-all of how to hold districts accountable.
Well, yeah, and of course, I think you're suggesting that some of the of the mechanisms for accountability for outcomes might not necessarily be financial. And that makes sense to me, and I think to the extent that you're in the process of trying to work on this issue, that certainly would fall within the purview of this group. The reason I raise the issue at all is because I don't see anything in the outline, in a quick read through the outline, that suggests that there are situations where innovation and new processes might actually save money and therefore ought to be considered as a way in which your formula might be reduced rather than increased. Now, it doesn't actually say that, I understand, either way, but it's easy to read this as saying, let's build a system for students, and then we'll add on to that by weights or some other mechanism additional funding for other things we want. I'm suggesting that there may actually be situations in which weights might actually go down because efficiencies are high or costs are low.
Chair Barnhart, I think you're right. I think the perspective that at least this outline portrays, and in my professional judgment, I would agree with. And since I wrote the outline, I guess that's not surprising. is that the formula is first and foremost about equity?
Yes. You wrote the outline. You get to interpret it.
That's right.
That's right.
So it's first and foremost, it's about equity. It's about getting the right amount of resources to the students that need them. But within that, we also want to make sure that we don't create incentives or other circumstances that work against other goals. And that's what we term efficiency. And so, you know, just as an example, reimbursing districts for whatever they spend on something is inefficient because it likely leads them to spend too much on that activity and not look for cost-cutting methods. So if you look really at the very end of this outline, Roman numeral 5D, mm-hmm. talk a little bit about what I term non-equity goals. And some of those are incentives for innovation, promoting best practices, and so forth. But I do want to emphasize that the formula, it really is about equity.
Yeah.
And if we don't achieve that, then the other pieces of it really don't matter.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Let me just add parenthetically that I completely agree with the comments of Representative Berger and Representative Gelser, but I think you do too, so you don't really need to hear my adding on to it. I would simply note that when I was on the Eugene School Board in the late 90s, we did tackle the transportation issue. At that time, the state provided 70% of the funds and the district provided 30%. That 30% was a sufficient incentive for us to figure out how to reduce our transportation costs. And what we did is we engaged the interest of Lane Transit District to transporting high school students if they live within a mile of the bus stop. And we actually bought bus passes for students on free and reduced lunch with Lane Transit District in lieu of transporting them all the way to school. It saved us a bundle of money, and that came out of our 30%, and the state saved off of their 70%. My suspicion is that the 90-10 districts may find that more difficult to do, but I'll tell you that at least in one 70-30 district, that was sufficient incentive to reduce costs.
Representative Barnhart, I agree with you, and I commend Eugene for doing that, but I would argue if you got to save a dollar for every dollar you saved, you might even look even harder.
Oh, of course.
Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Representative Gelser.
Thank you. And I know that we talk about transportation and the incentives a lot. If you go and talk to families in the state who are putting their kids on buses, many of them do not see an over expenditure in transportation because their kids are on bus rides that are too long, that are inefficient, and frankly are unsafe. Too many kids on buses, not adequately trained staff, especially when they're contracted out.
Yeah.
So I think that right now we already are cutting too many corners on our buses. When you have issues where kids are getting sprayed with antifreeze, it's an important part of the educational process to deliver kids to school. So I want us to be careful that we don't just assume that there's lavish money being spent on transportation that's wasted in the ed process, because their districts are struggling and they want every penny that they have, not just every dollar.
Right. And, of course, if I could, Representative, you've raised a different issue, too, and that is the wisdom of the current system we use for contracting with private vendors and the effects that has on some districts in their operation. But you're absolutely right. If you have a rural district with students spread out over 50 miles, that school bus is absolutely essential, because you won't get the kids to school if you don't do it.
And people won't if it's not safe. In our district, we see these signs up because they can't get enough bus drivers that say, school bus drivers needed, no experience necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not putting my kid on a giant hunk of metal going down the street if the requirement is no experience necessary.
Thank you. Well, so I opened another can of worms. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your update. Good luck with the work.
Thank you.
Yeah. Apportioning corporate income for broadcast industry.
Yeah.
thrilling title.
We're going to get tortured now.
If I could.
Oh, my gosh.
If I could,
Mr. Chair, when I saw this.
If I could, to the vice chairs. We have to earn our reputation as the WONT committee almost every meeting.
Oh, well, right there.
This is your chance for this meeting.
Starting with the clean air fee didn't count.
No, that was much simpler than that.
And the
all been warm up to this.
Right. Yes.
And now we're
getting school
down to it.
Funding formula.
Give us an introduction, please.
Do a lead into this fascinating topic.
Is this a walk-on?
Yes, this is. I'm going to set them up with why we include this on the agenda.
Don't get started.
In the last interim, going into the 13th session, we were in discussions with the Department of Revenue, their corporate unit, and we talked about some issues around apportionment. One of them, I think they came up, was the cost of performance that we had talked about. Another one was kind of an obscure, based on some obscure court decisions called the Joyce versus the Finnegan method, which has implications about how we treat the throwback rule and ways that at least on the surface, were consistent with our sales factor approach. So I'll leave it at that. The other thing that we discovered in that process was, and this is in discussions, Scott Berry brought this to my attention, representing the motion picture industry, that going from the Joyce method to the Finnegan method would also have definite implications for the broadcasting industry, not only in terms of the throwback, but in terms of the apportion of income to Oregon. That would be how we would measure that attributable income in Oregon. So the result of that is, the motion picture industry sent some representatives to us to talk with the Department of Revenue and us toward the end of last session. Chair Barnhart's legislative assistant was with us and kind of talked through some of the implications of that and suggested a proposal to find a specific method of apportioning income for this industry. And so that's what they're here for, to kind of discuss that concept. We have it on our potential list of draft requests for the committee for going into 14. So they're going to outline the approach they're suggesting to you, and we'll be working with them if you want to pursue it to determine what the specific revenue implications would be.
Great. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us. Scott Berry, on behalf of the Motion Picture Association of America. With me today is Brian O'Leary from NBC Universal, who will be addressing the technical issues for us today. But the depth of my knowledge, I think, has already been covered by committee staff, so I'll turn it over to the experts.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As Scott said, I'm Brian O'Leary, and although I'm here speaking on behalf of the Motion Picture Association, I work for NBC Universal. I'm their tax counsel, so the torture that you fear is what I live every day. And you may know NBC Universal as the company that produces in Oregon the television series Grimm. We've called Oregon home for 3 years, hopefully for many more. But more broadly, as Scott intimated, NBC Universal is a diverse media and entertainment company. And within our media assets, including theme parks and motion picture units, we have television networks, actually what we'll describe here as interstate broadcasters, because I think that's the term we've been working from. So one of those networks is the NBC network, which Grimm airs on. But we also have more than a dozen other cable programming networks. And those are networks that aren't over the air, but you actually receive through your cable operators or your direct broadcast satellite systems. So NBC Universal's profile is actually virtually the same, if not identical, to all of the other MPA member companies. And perhaps just for context, I should describe who they are. So the Motion Picture Association includes the following members. In addition to NBC Universal, we have the Walt Disney Company. We have Time Warner, Fox Entertainment, Viacom, CBS, Sony Pictures. I think that's everybody. So these businesses operate interstate broadcasters that generate revenues across multiple platforms, and it's how that income is taxed, which is really the purpose of this conversation. So just a quick 50-cent tour of the general principle of apportionment. So the way Oregon apportions income of multi-state businesses, and if you're a company and you're operating in a multitude of states, each state that you do business in is entitled to a tax a certain portion of your earnings. So the question is, how do you divide that up? So Oregon uses a principle, looks at your total sales, the company's total sales in the country, and they take whatever that portion of your sales is attributed to Oregon is the percentage of your income that is therefore taxed. So if it's 5% of your sales are Oregon sales, 5% of your income is therefore taxed in Oregon. And that's the method, by and large, that just about every state follows. So how do you determine what is an Oregon sale? And that's really the heart of this conversation. So the existing rule in Oregon is actually an old rule that's been around for actually more than 25 years and had been adopted by a number of states a good number of years ago. And that looks at viewing audience and generally describes looking at the total viewing audience in this state, which is Oregon, as compared to total audience around the country. And that percentage, whether it's 5%, 10%, 1%, whatever it is the amount of income that is therefore taxable in Oregon. So viewing audience, that's the rule. If you step back and just think about the general principle of apportionment as applied to the business community in general, what we're looking at is our company's sales, the sales that we generate to our customers. So if I was manufacturing widgets, or if NBCU was manufacturing widgets, and we were selling widgets to a wholesaler in Oregon, then if it's 10 widgets or 1,000 widgets, whatever percentage of those widgets are Oregon sales as compared to my total sales in the country, that percentage is how much I'm taxed in the state. It's a little different for this industry because the viewing audience isn't our customers. They're actually our customers' customers. So I just want to leave that for a moment and just kind of get to why we are in the position that we're in using this viewing audience rule. And it actually is going to go back a little bit in a time when there were only three networks. I think we all remember when that was, or at least most of us remember when there were three television. Okay, most. So there was a time where there were three television networks and they broadcast their signal to local television stations around the country. And those local television stations would then air their programming to the audience in that market. And everyone pull it down off their antenna, okay, their rabbit ears. Pretty simple construct, pretty simple method. Not our customers, but the method was at least workable in some rough way. So what's happened over the last 25 years is technology, time and competition has created a very different dynamic. So as I mentioned to you, NBC Universal is a diverse media company. 25 years ago, we had one network. Now we're pushing 20. and all of the MPA member companies are in the same situation. It is an expansion of cable programming. If you go to your, however you're receiving your television programming, there's 200, 300, 400, however many channels depending on your package. That's the market now. And what's allowed for that, of course, is technology. And all of those cable networks are contracting with cable operators like Comcast, Time Warner Cable, Cox Communications, whoever your cable provider is, or a direct broadcast satellite system, or an internet service. The point is, all of those cable networks are licensing their programming to a third party who then takes that programming, packages it up, and then transfers it to their customers, the subscribers, the viewing audience. So that's the industry from where we sit. On the consumer side, the development of technology has allowed for an important set of principles to exist. Programming watched whenever, wherever, however. And whether it's on your game console or your tablet or your mobile device or your PC, where the consumer is accessing content isn't generally sitting on their couch anymore. And that has led to a real change in how our relationship with our customers, which now includes DBS systems, cable operators, we still license to some local television stations, websites. There are more customers that we have, and there are more consumers on the back end that our customers have relationships with. What all of that has done is really clouded the question of how do we, as interstate broadcasters who have this diverse set of relationships with all of these content providers, these licensing companies, how do we measure our sales? Because viewing audience, I can't tell you where my customer's viewing audience is anymore with any degree of accuracy. What I can tell you is where my customer is. And I can also tell you, if I'm providing advertising services, whether it's to Nike or to GM or anyone else in between, I can tell you where that customer is located. And really, to get to the heart of this issue for us, is when you go back to the example of widget sellers, they know who their customer is because they're selling to them directly. For our industry, the states that have thought about how to tax interstate broadcasters have looked at how they tax other industries. Well, if I am selling widgets, I look to where that buyer is, where that customer is of that widget manufacturer. So is there a similar construct here? Of course there is. For interstate broadcasters, if I'm providing advertising services to Nike, I know where their headquarters is. I know where they're based. I know where GM is based. If I'm licensing programming to a local television station in Eugene, I know where they're based. Or if I'm licensing programming to Comcast, I know where they're based. And that is where the commercial domicile of our customers is. It's a concept that every state tax regime has, because each business can only have one commercial domicile. It's their seat of decision-making. It's where their operations are, the decision-making for their business operations predominantly occur. And states that have adopted a contemporary way to tax our industry, that is interstate broadcasters, have done so by looking at where is the commercial domicile of the interstate broadcaster's customer. And if it's in Illinois, for example, then 100% of that sale to that Illinois customer would be in my Illinois numerator. So going back to the apportionment formula, what's a sale in the state? If I'm selling to a business that is commercially domiciled, I'm providing advertising services to a business that's commercially domiciled in the state, 100% of that sales goes in the numerator. Very simple, just as if I was selling a widget. So as states like Michigan and Illinois and North Carolina and Florida have thought about how to apportion income for our industry, they have adopted this commercial domicile construct. So what does it do for the state? What does it do for the business community? Predictability, certainty. For us, there's no guessing. There's no question as well, is the viewing audience really tracking my projects that I'm licensing to my customers? Getting aside putting aside whether it's actually the right relationship to taxes based on, is it even an accurate measurement anymore? So states have made a decision that have thought about our industry recently and said certainty is important for us and the states, and this concept actually rises. Revenue will increase as the market improves. Why? Because one thing is certain. As the economy improves, revenues go up because advertising, the more advertising is put into the marketplace. So companies like GM and Nike, and I'm just using some basic examples, put more money in. So there is actually an upside to the state. And getting back to the upside for us, we don't have any guesswork. And guesswork is a real problem for financial statements. We know exactly where our customers are, and we can determine our tax liability to that state based on where their customers are located. And that's a very simple construct for us. It's auditable for the state. It's measurable for our financial statements. But that's really what the heart of this issue for us is how do we provide predictability and certainty? And I'm not saying that what other states do is a perfect guide, because Oregon, frankly, has been a state that has been at the forefront of contemporary tax policy in other areas, including single sales factor. Whether you think it's the right approach or not, Oregon has been very progressive in their tax policy. So this is something that's relatively new, but we think it's the fair and right approach for our industry and a proper method of apportioning for the state.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Berger, you're on a roll.
Well, I came to work, I guess, today. This is another case that, as a committee, we grapple with constantly. Tax policy can't keep up with technology. This is a classic example where we're grappling with technology that I don't even understand. But, you know, the tax policy is hard enough, the technology is even tougher. What you're suggesting, and other states have done this apparently, is that the sales be measured against what you sold to the reseller, be it the cable company or whoever. Is that
right?
Basically the heart of
That's
what you're
right.
suggesting?
Well,
all right, so in states that do this, who reports? You report to the tax authority that you sold to this authority, and then they report, yes, and then who gets taxed? You or the...
Important clarification. I should have incorporated this in my comments. Nothing about the relationship that our customers have, whether it's an advertiser or a cable operator or a local television station, their liabilities do not change. This is only about determining how interstate broadcasters apportion income to the state. So if we have 10 advertisers and you add that up as compared to our total sales across the country, whatever percentage those advertising revenues generate in Oregon, plus whatever we license in the state, it's all based on our customers here, and it's our customers here, the total revenue attributed to Oregon, as a percentage of the total revenue across the country.
And we would report
that.
You would report.
Just as we would today under the existing audience method, is we're using an approximation, and now what we're talking about is still filing the same sort of corporate tax return, but now we're providing certainty based on what our customers are. And when the Department of Revenue comes in and says, well, how did you calculate your sales factor, which they do today, I mean, that's just part of an audit, and every business goes through it. They ask the question, well, how did you determine your liability? I can pull up every sale that we've had to an Oregon customer, and they can verify it, that they're a commercially domiciled business and that the bill of sale reflects the actual transaction, and that's what we put it in our sales factor. It's an audit trail that's actually relatively easy to measure.
Please.
So what happens if these are... If that commercially domiciled thing, this is really a staff question. So,
it's one I have too.
Well, I'm not even sure if I can formulate the question, let alone get it an answer. So, suppose there's a cable company. It's not commercially domiciled, but it has sales in Oregon. So that would be reported, and then the OR would then measure the sales of that. He'd report, his company would report, and then they would report, and this is what DOR would be measuring. Is that how that works, Paul?
DOR would be measuring those customers who are located in Oregon, who are domiciled in Oregon. We know who they are, and that would count toward their sales factor.
Does this work for things like Netflix?
So I'll give you, there are, you talked about one of our customers.
Netflix?
Just like, absolutely, just like Hulu and Apple TV, and there are a variety of others.
And you left out Amazon on your list.
And Amazon, that's right. So these are our customers, and if we're providing content, licensing content to them, just as we would a local television station or to a cable operator, where is the commercial domicile of that company? That's the question, is where are they located? So if it is Amazon and they're based in
Seattle.
Yeah, exactly. Then that's where the sale would be attributed to. If it is a Oregon-based company, whether it's an advertiser on the NBC Sports Network or USA Cable or Bravo or any of the others, the sale is attributed to Oregon. And that's, let me give you a sense of perspective. So I'll stay with the Nike example just because it's an understood, commercially domiciled Oregon company. If they transact business with ESPN for $1 million, then that $1 million is included in the Oregon sales numerator, the sales percentage that is attributed to Oregon. And if GM, just staying with our examples, has $1 million that they also place in advertising on ESPN, that $1 million is included in the ESPN Michigan sales percentage. So that's $1 million in Oregon. Under existing law today, what the state would do is take the audience percentage for Oregon, which is 1.2%, and take 1.2% of each $1 million, and that's how you would calculate the liability and construct your tax return that way. So
But what about Netflix? They're not domiciled here.
But they will be. So I don't want to speak for any other taxpayers, but what we're describing here is that, so Netflix would do business in Oregon, and they'd go through the same construct that we're describing here. Although we're talking about the MPA member companies, interstate broadcasters, we are not by any stretch alone. There are hundreds of them. And the question is, what's the right method for attributing the income earned by those interstate broadcasters to Oregon or any other state? So they might be our customer, but they're a taxpayer on their own, just like Comcast, just
Amazon.
Like Amazon, just like Apple and all these other organizations. And just to say it again, we're not looking to disturb the tax liability for manufacturers and cable operators in this discussion. This is just interstate broadcasters.
Got it. I'm beginning to see a dim light in the end of this tunnel.
Well, let me kind of build on that a little bit. It sounds to me that if we went universally to this approach across the country, states that have domiciled in their states businesses like Nike or General Motors or large franchisees of your networks that own stations all across the country. I don't know whether any of those exist or not, but I'm making that up. Those states would do very well under this formula. A small state with nobody large domiciled in their state would do less well than they do under the existing formula. That's neither positive nor negative. It's simply trying to understand how this thing is likely to work. Have I got it?
So it really is. How does your state operate as a seat of commerce? If Oregon has multiple business interests that are either advertisers or distributors of programming, we have multiple television stations that license directly from us as well as from Comcast and other large networks, large companies. If you have businesses in your state that are placing advertising on networks or licensing programming, you'll do well. If you're, and I don't want to pick on any particular state, but if you're a jurisdiction that is more of a market state for sales into the state as opposed to actually seat of commerce, you're not going to do as well. That is true. And right now, if every state were to have the audience percentage, regardless of whether they are a developed seat of commerce, they're going to do relatively well as compared based on their population. And that's, so there's always going to be winners and losers, and it's just what's the methodology that you're basing it on. Mm-hmm. Right now it's based on audience in some states.
So I'm a bit confused about the motivation. I think what you've described is, what you said is that you can, you actually have an auditable system in place to tell how to set up the distribution of income properly, because if you use the method of attributing income based on the person you directly sell to.
Correct.
Whereas you don't under the current system.
That's right.
Under the old system, as it were. But if I'm a state, and of course we represent the state of Oregon.
Right.
If I'm a state, I'm going to want to go to the method you desire if it improves my income. And I'm going to want to stick with the current method if it would decrease my income to go to the new method.
Yeah.
Wouldn't I?
Yeah. I certainly understand, regardless of whether the policy merit bears out. If you're looking at it from just a pure revenue perspective, then I could see the argument that you would pick whatever method generates most revenue, putting aside long-term impact, what it means to business development, and your state as a seat of commerce. But yes,
right.
If you're just looking at revenue.
Okay, so now you've added another factor that I hadn't thought about, and that is the factor having to do with secondary effects and what that means in terms of development of new employment, new economic activity. Can you describe a little bit how this tax change might affect that? Because I don't think you said that yet.
No, I haven't. And so I'll go back to the state's current apportionment formula, which is designed not to punish a business based on their investment in the state. Whether you believe in the policy or not, the simple math works as follows. Single sales factor apportionment, that is what I described at the outset, taxes based only on our sales, is completely irrelevant what you do in terms of developing infrastructure here or creating jobs. And the thinking on that is, if you are merely tracking your state's role as a location for businesses' sales, then this concept is consistent with that, because we are now looking only under this proposal at what our relationships are with Oregon customers, and it has nothing to do with the rise and fall of the population and nothing to do with how successful we are in developing our own business, bringing another television series here or anything else related to our business's investment in the state or potential investment in the state. So this is neutral to that, if not favorable, but it is not at all hostile.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
Yes. Apropos the last discussion or the one before that on carbon tax.
I don't know if he was here then.
No.
I'm sorry I missed that.
Yeah, I know you are.
yeah, right.
The danger here is that our indigenous, if I could use that term, companies that are big advertisers could potentially pay more. And would that be discouraging to large indigenous companies? And that is the other side of this equation. Am I right?
Because
he keeps talking about big advertisers, and we know who we're talking about here.
Remember, though, Representative Berger, we're talking about these interstate broadcasters. So, I mean, this wouldn't affect, for example, Nike's apportionment. So we're talking about the broadcasters themselves.
But they would pay more. Okay.
The interstate broadcasters would pay more if the calculation based on their customers exceeds what it does based on the audience or kind of the general population.
Okay, so it wouldn't hurt an indigenous.
And my guess is it'll affect different companies or different corporations differently. So we're going to have some that will gain from this and some that won't, that will lose some from it.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, the issue here.
I just don't want to discourage good indigenous companies that would do a lot of advertising. Telling me this does not do that.
It does not.
Thank you. That's what I'm trying to get at.
It's not by your head.
But, Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, you might even argue that more of that money would stay here in Oregon.
If that would be desirable.
All right. Paul, do we have any estimates yet on what the effect of this kind of a change would be on the bottom line?
Mr. Chair, we haven't done anything formally. We've had some discussion, looked at some potential language, and talked to the Department of Revenue a bit about that, but we haven't formalized an estimate. And we would, if the committee so desires, we'll proceed in that and come up with some preliminary numbers for you.
I personally think, and I obviously don't speak for the committee, but I personally think that it makes sense when the industry comes in and asks for a change of method, we ought to consider it seriously and explore it and see whether it makes sense to the state of Oregon or not, in our opinion. So that does make sense to me to at least put in some effort on that. Obviously, I don't want you to put 40% of your time in on this issue, take that into account.
We will do that, Mr.
Chair. I would concur also with this dovetails nicely with our other efforts on the broadcast industry. We certainly value it as an industry more specifically in Oregon than others have courted you. And so I think that this discussion has been very useful, and I think I do see sort of some dim light that you could sort of put a little better form to, Paul. That would be helpful.
Okay, we'll work on that.
Anything else?
Just one last comment.
Yes, please. Yes.
And some of our initial looks at this potential revenue would show an increase in revenue, but we'll make sure that that's accurate. And then we'd be happy to add language to the bill that just sends that straight to the tax credit for the film industry, if that's... I didn't want to miss the opportunity.
Yeah, right.
You should take your shots when they come.
Thank
right.
you, Mr. Chair.
That's right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your taking the trip all the way out to the left coast to visit with us. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Special session bill review, revenue bill, implementation issues.
Mr. Chair, this is for those of you who have forgotten the special session. It was to remind you.
I pulled the plug.
Tried to build the middle block against it. We have put together a summary in your packet of this. It's a summary of the session itself. So there's a very brief discussion of the bills that were approved in early October. And we also had a brief description of the policy rationale. But, of course, the focus of our research, obviously, is around House Bill 3601, which had, when you count them, had, aside from some of the targeted expenditures, you really had six major tax changes embedded in that bill. So those things were all issues that had been discussed in various phases by either this committee or the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, but they were put together. If you look on in the research report that Chris is putting up there, you can see those summarized on Table 1. And to remind you what the implications of that and the revenue impact of those individual components that you discussed during the session. And then the Table 2 kind of breaks it out by the fund type. So keep in mind that we have the majority of the cigarette tax initially, and then all of it later going into the Oregon Health Authority Fund for mental health purposes. And there were some movements in and out of the rainy day fund. So that shows up there as well. The main thing we wanted to do in this research report, if you go on into page 4, was to put together some detailed analysis of those tax changes, look at the distributional effects, and Chris has put that together, starting with Table 3, which deals with a combination of the measures, but then gets into the individual measures, and I'll turn it over to Chris to go through the results of some of the analysis he's done.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And as Paul indicated, I'm just going to not walk through the report page per page or number by number, but just touch on some of the highlights of some of the tables and the analysis that was done over the past few months. The Table 3, the personal income tax changes, as Paul mentioned, there were 7 income tax changes. Only 4 of them are really amenable to a distributional kind of analysis. So the 4 that are in here are the non-passive income, the medical deduction subtraction, the personal exemption credit, and the earned income tax credit. So the item I'd like to point out here in this table, and the format here is generally the same for all these distribution tables. It's our standard distribution table that I think everybody's familiar with, where we have this first block of all returns and then the second block of single returns and the joint returns, so we provide that breakout. The key column here is under the change in the tax return or in the tax liability for these filers. So for these 4 policies combined, there was a revenue loss of $26.2 million, or at least projected for tax year 2015. And I should say all of the reference points are tax year 2015. The policies are staggered in terms of when they take effect, and 2015 is the first year in which they're all in effect. So rather than bouncing around different tax years, we just stuck with tax year 2015. And so the combined effect here is that for filers less than $40,000, there's a slight revenue, there's a slight tax reduction. And this is mainly driven by the earned income tax credit, but the change of the additional medical deduction to subtraction also contributes to that reduction. These are filers who generally don't itemize their deductions, so under prior law they couldn't take the additional medical deduction, but with the change to the subtraction they will be able to deduct some amount of medical expenses. At the other end of the income spectrum, for where all filers combine here, the $500,000 and over, there's a revenue loss of $36 million. And that's driven by the change in the tax rates for the non-passive income. And for all other filers in between those two extremes, with income between roughly $40,000 and a couple $100,000, there is a tax increase. And that's driven by the elimination of the personal exemption credit for filers over $100,000 single or $200,000 joint, and also the change in the medical deduction to the subtraction. These filers are losing the deduction and are claiming a subtraction that is capped, so it's a smaller amount that they're allowed to deduct. And so the net impact is a revenue gain for the state and a tax increase for those filers. But in total, for these 4 policies combined for tax year 2015, we expect a revenue loss of just about $26 million.
Please.
Chris, let's get baseline here, because I'm looking at this for the first time and I haven't studied up.
Okay.
A negative number on the change thing is negative to the taxpayer or to the state?
The state. This is the revenue impact to the general fund.
Okay. So I just want to make sure our negatives are is the filers or to the state, what a negative means. Okay, and that's throughout this report.
Yes, and all of Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, just like all of the revenue impacts we do, the baseline is the current law general fund forecast.
Right.
Although we can get, I'll try not to get too twisted up with a frame of reference there.
But if we did, if the special session didn't happen, that's baseline.
Correct.
And this report. Okay, thank you.
Right, well, of course, and this is personal income tax. Doesn't include the other changes we made on the tobacco tax or on corporate taxes. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. That first table that Paul pointed out, the table one, is the overall package. And so there is a revenue increase to the general fund for the 13-15 biennium for the changes.
And
this is only personal income tax.
And it's only for the 1 year. This does not move
and,
out over time.
And one of the significant pieces of that is the lower rates for the non-passive income doesn't take effect until 2015. So all of the tax increase measures, the elimination of the personal exemption credit, and then the change in the medical deduction, which raise revenue and are included in this table, take effect in 2013. So their net impact for tax years 13 and 14 is a revenue increase to the general fund.
But in 15, it reverses.
Right, because that other policy. This is one of the challenges. We often get requests for these distributional tables, and the time frame is really important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that really strikes out about this package is that the taxpayers are very different groups of taxpayers. The earned income credit is one group of taxpayers, the personal exemption credit are at the other end of the income spectrum, the additional medical deduction are for people age 62 and over, and then the non-passive income will be for business owners who actively manage their businesses. So we debated about providing this kind of table because you're taking a bunch of different taxpayers and meshing them together, but we did get a lot of requests for this table and we can produce it, so time will tell whether or not that was a good thing.
Well, and based on when we actually get the money, the effect of this change is likely to be in the year 16, isn't it? 15-17 would be the budget cycle.
Yes. That's another important thing here. This is tax year 15. These are personal income filers. This is calendar year 15.
Right.
So that straddles two fiscal years, two biennia. And the revenue impacts for the biennial impact, we take the, not to get too much into that detail, but these are liability changes. When that actually hits the revenue stream is another adjustment mm-hmm. that we make. And the liability in any given year will hit the revenue stream either through a change in withholding payments, which presumably the department will change withholding tables, or a change in estimated payments that taxpayers make.
Right. And if I could add, mm-hmm. I think that most of the people who are in this category above 500,000, where the big minus sign is, are people who are filing quarterly tax payments. Have I got that right?
Yes, they
that be that being the case, you don't really figure out what that number is until they settle up in April of the next year. And that's the reason I say the impact is probably 16 in terms of actual dollars in.
Mr. Chair, you have hit on one of the subtleties and nuances that we spend a lot of time
right.
talking about and thinking about. Yes.
And of course, you're absolutely right that the numbers, the way you described them here, don't necessarily describe when the effect on our budget is.
Correct.
Thank you. Go ahead.
And even to add on to that, for a new policy like this non-passive income, and you're going to hear from the CPA shortly, and there's still a lot of time between now and 2015, but as they start to make those estimated payments, there'll be a lot of questions for exactly what they pay in and whether or not they know that they're going to take advantage. This is an optional program, and they may not know in the first half of the year that will whether or not they would participate, which just adds to some of the uncertainty around the timing of the impact.
And I think that's a question we'll ask the CPAs, because that's a very good question.
Okay, and I'm just going to touch lightly on all of these, so if there are any questions, feel free to. So then the next section talks about the Schedule E non-passive income. Table 4 are just the preferential rates.
Oops.
And they range from 7% to 9.9%, and there are the legislature you built in a corrective mechanism for tax years 2019 and 2023 where these rates may change. In 2019, they may increase depending on the accuracy of the estimates. and then in 2023 they could go up or down again, but they won't exceed the 9.9% or be below these rates. Table 5 is just a conceptual table of how the calculation might appear. I'll just skip over that because you're going to hear from the CPAs. Now, Table 6 and then in the next one, Table 7, are two distributional tables for the non-passive income. So this table is identical in format to the other one, but this is just the non-passive income. So you can see that for tax year 2015, it's an estimated revenue loss of $91 million. And that is concentrated on filers with at least $100,000 of income. And then between the single and joint returns, the majority of the impact would we expect to fall on joint returns. About $78 million of the $91 million revenue loss for joint filers. And this distribution is by the taxpayer's total income. And now as we move to Table 7, this is a distribution table on the amount of this non-passive income. And so the categories here are the amount of the income that would be potentially subject to these tax rates. And in total, for 2015, we're projecting about 148,000 filers will have either a business income or loss used in this definition. And that total net income would be about $3.4 billion, the $3,414 million. But you can see of that, the loss number is just under $1.5 billion. So they won't participate in the program. And for those filers with a positive non-passive income amount, there are about 101,000 of those filers. That 100,000 is a subset of the 148,000. But of those 101,000, we're projecting only about 77,000 of them will participate in the program. And that has to do, again, it's an optional program, and it has to do with personal deductions, Schedule A deductions, not being allowed to offset this income. And in a simplistic manner, if you have, and this is included in the text, if you have a taxpayer whose only income is non-passive income and it's $60,000, and they have $20,000 of itemized deductions, then under the traditional method of calculation, their gross tax would be, I believe it was around $3,150. The gross tax under this calculation would be $4,200, the 60,000 times the 7. So they would opt out. And the taxpayers would be able to make that choice every year. So there's no long-term commitment. And so that's why our projections right now, about 80% of the taxpayers would participate in the program.
I think what you're saying is that some taxpayers will do better by sticking with the current rule.
That's correct.
And some will do better by going to the new rule, and they get to pick.
They get, yeah, that's correct.
Thank you.
And that all has to do with the Schedule A deductions.
Right.
Not offsetting this income. And so the thing from the takeaway from this table is the distribution of where most of this income is. So of the 78,000 that will participate in the program, about 44,000 of them have less than $25,000 of this eligible income. In terms of the revenue impact, you get it's as we see elsewhere within the personal income tax program, you get a smaller number of taxpayers, but the amount of income is much higher, so the revenue impact gets a little bit larger. So for those 44,000 with less than $25,000 of income, we expect a tax impact of about $6.1 million. At the other end of the spectrum, for filers with more than $1 million of this income, there are only about 250 filers, but that'll be about $10 million of income of revenue impact.
So, and if I'm reading this right, 21% of the participants that you expect would fall in the 250 to 500.
It will be 21% is the share of their revenue impact.
Okay, the share of their revenue. Okay.
If you go to the left.
So it sort of targets that group in some sense.
it's something of a tautology with the way it's set up, where you have more income, the larger the income. If somebody has $1 million of income, of this kind of income, their revenue impact is going to be larger than somebody with only $25,000 of income, because it's just more income subject to lower rates.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
But that 21% of that revenue impact for the 250 to 500 category, over to the left a couple of columns, there are 2,200 filers, which is about 2.8% of the filers.
Ah, that's partly a function of the number of filers in there.
Right, you have a smaller number of filers, but larger income.
These are complicated.
Yeah, now, if I've understood you correctly, you've got some percentages on here. You've got three different share columns. The first share column is the percentage of taxpayers, I think.
Correct.
The second share column is the percentage of income.
Correct.
And the third share column is the percentage of the tax change.
Correct.
Okay. So these numbers fit very well with all the other numbers we've ever looked at around the distribution of income, income taxes, and anything similar to that, don't they?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a microcosm.
Most people fall at the top of the table and have small impact per each. There's lower income, small impact for each person, small impact on our overall revenue, no matter what way you're doing. Fewer people fall at the bottom of the table, lots of income, few people, lots more impact on our revenue, regardless of what you're doing.
Correct.
Okay. So these are perfectly predictable. I couldn't predict the exact numbers, obviously, but the way the table comes out is easily predicted based on all the other tables we've looked at that are similar to this.
I don't often say perfectly predictable.
Of course not. I use the word perfect. Certainly the trends are predictable.
They were unsurprising.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is a good table for people to study to understand what these tax changes actually do to individuals and families.
This table focuses on the income that is at the heart of this policy.
Yeah.
And just to try to tie it in with the other tables to make, I think it's human nature to try and sum up to put the pieces together. The bottom left of this table right down here, you'll see that the total number of filers there, the 1,704,136, is consistent throughout. Those are the number of filers. The 148 will be potential participants, and the 1,555,000 are the number of filers who aren't affected in any way, shape, or form by this tax calculation because they don't have this kind of income.
And you know, it would be interesting to distribute them on this income category list.
They would all show up as zero on this one. And in terms of the total taxpayers, that's what Table 6 does. It includes them and their income level. So if you scroll back to Table 6.
Got it.
Okay, they're already in there.
That's everybody.
This is how you get
to see
everybody.
Great.
That's everybody.
And that's by total income.
So the 1.704 is the same in both tables.
Right, and that's why that little tab is included in Table 7.
Right. Thank you. That's very helpful. Now everyone on the committee understands this perfectly.
About 10 seconds before we move on to the next.
Please go ahead.
Chart 1 is just the projection of this income. We only have historical information from 2005 through 2010, and at that it's imperfect information because this hasn't been a relevant part of the tax calculation. The one item I'd add here is the growth rate is expected to increase in 2015. But moving along, so that's it for the past non-passive income. There's more detail in the text. The next piece is the additional medical deduction. I think the committee is familiar with that. Chart 2 here is just a representation of the phase-outs. That's the red and the blue. Those are the caps. And the green line is the historical average of the deduction amount, the average deduction amount for taxes 2009 and 2011. So the deduction amount will be being reduced from that green line down to either the blue line or the red line. Table 8 are just some examples. Chart 3 is just the projection of the deduction, and that the strong increase in the blue line is where the cost of this tax expenditure was expected to grow faster than the general fund, and the red dashed line is the new projection.
Okay.
And then table 9 is the distributional table for this provision. Again, same structure. And the one item I would point out here is that the revenue loss to the general fund, the negative numbers for filers less than $40,000, these are the folks who take the standard deduction and will now be able to deduct some amount of medical expenses. So that's a loss. That's a tax reduction for them, a loss reduction to the general fund. And then the positive numbers are the revenue gain to the general fund and the reduction in the deduction amount. So those are kind of, those are a net number. And then things get a little bit routine now. They have the personal exemption credit. Chart 4 is just an example of how the prior law, which had a phase down that had been in place since 2007, and that's the red line, and now with the special session bill, there's a cliff. And this is just for a single filer, so the cliff is at the $100,000.
This doesn't apply to joint filers?
Mr. Chair, it does apply to joint filers. I was just trying to eliminate or reduce the number of charts.
Okay.
The message would be the same. The numbers would just be a little bit different.
Could I back up just for a second and ask you to look at chart 3 again? It looks to me, based on that chart, as though the effect of this is that this slowly decreases in real terms over the years, because it's about $40 million for a tax year in the future, rather than having this hugely escalating cost. So I suppose it's reasonable to say that the problem that some of us perceived with this thing eating the budget is gone.
Mr. Chair, with the parameters that are on the new policy, you're correct, there are a number of reasons for that. One, the deduction is capped. The cap is not adjusted for inflation. And over this time period, there are every other year, there's a one-year increase in the eligibility age, which helps keeps it level. If you look at the tail end of the graph from 2021 to 2023, it starts to tick up a little bit.
Right.
So some of that growth will come back again as the dampening effect of the age increase goes away. But the inflation won't be a factor because there is a cap as medical costs increase. The one wild card is always how the new healthcare law might affect medical expenditures, but to stay away from healthcare.
Small wild card, small issues.
Yeah, small.
We may have fixed a problem that in a couple of years won't exist, perhaps. Who knows?
Or
it might get worse.
Created another monster.
They created another monster. Yes, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're back at table chart 4 and then on.
Yeah. Chart 4, that was the phase out. Table 10 is just a condensed version of the distributional table for the personal exemption credit. We collapsed to all of those income categories where there was zero impact. And then brief description of the earned income credit, and again the same table for here, compressed the other direction where all of the zeros for the tax change for filers $40,000 in income over, which is zero, just collapsed into one category.
And there's no federal tax change because the people in these groups don't pay any federal tax anyway.
Generally, the itemized deduction piece, the cross deductibility. So that's it for the personal income taxes and a whirlwind of tables and charts. The corporate tax bracket, here we can see that for tax on the far right, the tax years 2013, the prior tax bracket, 7.6% bracket began at 10 million. It's reduced to 1 million. And then table 13 is a sectoral chart of the tax impact for 2015. We're expecting around 700 corporations to be affected. And so that's about 2.4% of all of them, and about a $20 million tax increase, with the sector that we expect to have the largest tax increase being the finance and insurance sector at about $4 million. Then there's just a description of the IC DISC and the tax incentives here. This is another new provisional law that we don't have any historical information on. So it just describes the new tax expenditures that were created through that mechanism. And then there's a table on the cigarette tax rate increase. By 2018, the tax rate will be $1.33, and that moves us up from 29th to 27th in terms of state-by-state comparisons.
Assuming nobody else changes their tax, right?
Correct. It's kind of a restriction of presenting this kind of table.
Questions, comments?
Good stuff, Chris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a great piece to help us understand this bill.
Thank you. We try to put in all of the information requests that we had over the past several months, and try to distill it into one piece that could be shared, and you can delve into it and probably come up with more questions as you investigate the numbers. So that was really it.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay. Then we, as kind of part of the follow-up discussion and really around the implementation issues, we have actually Rob Douglas had spoke with the chair, and we had asked Rob to help us put together a panel of CPAs, Rob representing the CPAs, and I see Doug Henney is here as
panel of one.
Okay. All right. Okay. So we have one, Doug Henney here to represent the CPA.
So we're ready.
I think we are.
Please come up. Thank you.
Let's see our other panel members.
Rob, did you want to come too? No? Okay. His conversation with me was sufficient. He made it clear we were going to hear from the CPAs.
Yes.
Lucas. How you doing, Doug?
Good morning. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Doug Henney. I'm a CPA with the firm of Eisler Northwest in Portland. I'm the head of their tax department. I've been doing taxes for at least 35 years. I represent the Oregon Society of CPAs, who have been working with the legislature I've been doing it for at least 30 years and went on well before that. I also happen to be on the Council of Economic Forecast Advisors, so I know the difficulty it is that Chris and Paul have getting the information together, and I don't envy that job as regards to the passive income tax, because it's a very complicated provision. We've been asked to report on the implementation issues, any potential legislative clarification that we see that might need to be made, and just to talk about some of the implementation issues and the sort of things that give us heartburn, or that will give us heartburn as we're trying to prepare these tax returns, and as the Department of Revenue tries to audit these returns. So that's take a different tact. You've been provided with the report. The copy is on the screen. And I'll just hit the highlights, and I'll be welcome to answer any questions you have beyond that.
That would be great. Thank you.
Non-passive income. It's something that came in 1986. Even at that, as many years as that's been, it's been a very complicated provision of the tax law. It has been, in fact, part of the regulations aren't out yet, even after all these decades. Now, I'm not sure that that'll affect too much this bill, but it's a very complicated provision. Oregon, under this special session law, will follow most of the rules, but they are diverting in a couple of some very complicated ways, and I'll try to cover a few of those. first of all, I'm not sure how the program is going to get done to, or if they'll even do that, or you know, how the programming with the computer software is going to work, get this in the system. I realize computers are pretty sophisticated, but Oregon isn't the most populated state in the Union, and getting the programming set up might be rather difficult. As we're sitting at our desk during tax season, trying to implement this and decide if we're going to do it for our clients or decide with our clients, we're essentially going to have to compute Oregon tax twice and decide which is the better of the two ways. And it's an irrevocable election on a year-to-year basis, so you may not have all the information. There might be corrected partnership returns, might be an audit or something. So the irrevocability of the election is, I think that'll give us heartburn. And some of the other issues that we see that are in the passive loss rules, which don't seem to be in this legislation. One is the issue of married spouses. If under the passive loss rules, what they say is that, and I'd be happy to summarize what those rules are, but what they essentially say is that if one spouse is not passive, they're materially involved in the business, then both spouses are. This legislation appears to say that the person with the income has to be materially involved in the business, and so I suspect that my wife, if my wife and I were partners, that she wouldn't get advantage of the lower rates, and I would. I'm just, that might be something that might require some clarification, or I'm just not sure exactly how that would work. Another part is in my business, and I'm a partner in a partnership. If I retire, I worked there for 35 years or however long. If I retire, the federal rules say that I continue to be material for like 5 years. But under these rules, I would not be actively involved in that first year retirement or thereafter. So I presumably would not qualify for the lower tax rate. Another complication, and I'm not sure how this is going to work out, is that there's an issue under the federal passive loss rules about what the business is. You have to be materially involved in the business. So the question is, if I've got, let's say I have own a restaurant chain, it's got you know, five restaurants, and each of them owns the real estate, you know, maybe I'm materially involved in one of them, maybe I'm materially involved in all of them, maybe the real estate is involved in the business or not. And for federal, you can make what are called grouping elections, where you can, within some parameters, choose to combine them all or not combine them all. And they let you change every couple of years whenever there's a tax law change that might impact whether you make an election to do it one way or the other. So I'm not sure in this context how the, you know, being actually involved in a business, if you have to look at each separate LLC or partnership or corporation separately, or if you can combine them, if you need to combine them the same way you do for federal, that's going to be something that we'll need to maybe make a new election for federal if this law requires continuity with what you do for the federal return. So that's going to be...
good notes on all this stuff, don't you?
Let's see. The law specifically excludes income that comes through a pass-through entity that's interest, dividends, and capital gains. If you have a business which sells business assets and has a gain, the gain on those, or the excess that you sell it for above what you paid for, it's treated in some context as a capital. It's called a 1231 gain. It's treated in some context as a capital gain, but it's not really a capital gain. It's just taxed if it like a capital gain. So I'm unclear as to whether that would be included in this lower tax rate, because again, it's not really a capital gain, and the law specifically excludes capital gains. But it goes on the capital gain form, and it's mixed in this mixing pot of capital gains and losses. So I'm not looking forward to that calculation.
Well, if I could, it sounds as though the calculation would be relatively simple, but you're not sure which category it belongs in.
Right.
Okay.
Let's see. I think that's really the main kind of the main overview. We have more points, which I'd be glad to discuss, but that's kind of the highlights.
So is it fair to say that the issues that you're raising are ones that apparently weren't looked at when the bill was drafted originally? I mean, that's my take on it. It may or may not be yours. And that as you got into the details of this thing, these are the kinds of questions you come up with. It looks to me, just based on what you're saying, that all of them are of the sort of, we don't know which category you intended that particular circumstance to fall into.
I think that's a good part of it. You're right.
Okay. Yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. And this is maybe a question for staff, for the department, and for us to think about. But in terms of implementation of these tax rules, are these clarifications that on a typical basis we make legislatively, or that falls to the rulemaking process as the department is processing returns and giving direction? That's just a question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, that's kind of leading into our next section on bill draft requests. We do have a placeholder for things that we've already identified that need to be clarified legislatively. I think there is a combination of things that we would maybe rule related mm-hmm. from a Department of Revenue standpoint. Deanna is going to come up to brief the committee next on kind of from the department's issues they've identified, but definitely we found some things, for example, around the implementation of the waiver on penalties, for example, that wasn't put in clearly or correctly in the mm-hmm. bill, so mm-hmm. we know those kind of things have to be clarified. So we will definitely have a bill that will for you to look at for in February that will address some of those. But you also have, keep in mind, too, that you've got a longer period for the, you know, this obviously right. being the most complicated element of the package is the non-passive tax rates. You have, you know, until 2015, so you could even look perhaps to do something early in the 15 session
right.
if you needed.
Right.
If we had to. Yeah, just to add to that, we're allowed to submit three bills under the rule as a committee, and my intention is to have one of them be the technical fix bill mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that addresses not just this issue, but all the other issues in the tax bill that we passed during the special session. Because as Paul points out, there are a number of other issues. It may or may not be controversial. I simply don't know at this point, but it will be boring reading. I promise you that. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Haney, very much for it. It appears to me, and this is not new news to me, that when you take off into a new direction, a new way of looking at a tax policy that is as complex as this one, there are massive numbers of questions that you as a tax practitioners say, wait a minute, it doesn't specify, and I'm down here in the weeds, and I have a client, and I have to get this job done. And you've kind of done a high-level analysis of this, I think, without ever having actually done it, because you haven't filed a return under this yet. And I predict that when you do, the number of questions will be exponentially larger. And here we are trying to anticipate that for you to try and help you and your clients get through that. But on the other side of the equation, I'm, as a policymaker, looking at Chris's chart and saying, how close is he? After you've done your work, how close is Chris in nailing its impact? And DOR never, those poor people have never tracked this information around passive and non-passive. They have no idea how to get at how close Chris is or what the policy. We've made a huge policy change, and we're just stepping off into the unknown here. And whether we end up knowing or not will depend a lot on you as a practitioner and the folks that help us with this saying, here's an unintended consequence that's popped up immediately, and you need this feedback. So I'm looking to you and your folks who've been so responsive to do this even more for us, and DOR the same, because what we don't know about this policy, in my opinion, is much greater than what we know. It's sort of like a carbon tax. It looks good on paper, but then when you go to do it, it gets really tricky. And
you're recapitulating the conversation I had with Rob and my charge to him.
And also, I would submit that your fees are going to go up for certain clients because you aren't going to be doing two calculations for free. And I think that is also part of this that we aren't even talking about. I looked at this and said, that's full employment for CPAs, and they don't want it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you're right. That time of year, I work as many hours as I can physically put up with. And something that we already have brought up is and we did put in our report, is how many companies do not currently qualify that could easily qualify for this lower tax rate, with people converting from proprietorships to partnerships or S corporations, C corporations becoming an S corporation, or even things beyond that. So yeah, I don't envy what Chris has had to do on this, because there's probably no way to do that part of the calculation.
Well, I just want you to know that I appreciate that on the ground, you're the folks that really have to do this for your clients, and it's problems and difficulties. I appreciate your willingness to come forward and help us make it work or decide where it's unworkable, and all we're partnered up here, and I just appreciate your efforts, and your feedback is critical.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I've been doing this for 30 years. We enjoy doing it. It's a great way for us to learn the rules better, and we like to do whatever we can. We're always open to and willing to help as we can.
Thank you very much, and I would simply echo what Representative Berger has said. We have benefited, the state of Oregon has benefited greatly from the expertise of you and your organization as we try to study the tax laws and understand them better and make sense out of them in ways that reduce the complexity for Oregonians, incidentally for you, but that's not the real reason for doing it, of course.
Thank you.
I know that you and your organization have put hundreds, thousands of hours into this kind of process, and we appreciate your willingness to do it yet again.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything else for him today? Thank you. We very much appreciate it. We will be in touch as we continue working on these issues. I've read ahead a little bit and realized there's a whole lot of other issues that in your paper that you didn't touch on in your testimony, and some of those look daunting to me as well. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, last but not least, we have Department of Revenue, and Deanna is here to go through some implementation issues that they've begun to identify, and of course we've been working closely with them on possible legislation.
Good morning, everyone. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack. I'm representing Department of Revenue, and I'm here to talk to you about some of the more technical issues with House Bill 3601. And I think I'll just go ahead and start with the reduced rate, since you guys are already on that topic. I was going to go in the order of the bill, but I think I'll just do this now. What we're hearing, and a lot of this you just heard from Doug, is that it is going to be difficult for practitioners to implement. One of the concerns that I'm hearing from the practitioner community is that not always do the CPAs know the number of employees or the employee information, because they have a payroll service doing that. So that's something that we want to be aware of. We're also getting questions about whether a husband and wife joint venture partnership is eligible for the rate, because they can elect to file a Schedule C or a Schedule F, which is a sole proprietorship. So that's something we're not clear on right now. We believe that they wouldn't qualify because they've made an election to file as a sole proprietorship. So if you want something different, you'd need to let us know that. Doug already talked about the material participation issues, and one of the issues that we were not clear on is whether the reduced rate applies to all qualifying income. So if an Oregon resident, as you know, they're taxed on all income from all sources worldwide. So if they're materially participating in income that's maybe sourced from Idaho, do you want that reduced rate to apply to that non-Oregon source income? And right now, the way the bill is drafted, it does appear to apply to all of their income. That would be a policy choice you'd want to clarify. And then, of course, Doug did hit on the complex issues such as grouping that will make these returns difficult to audit. They'll probably be more lengthy, probably result, because of the complexity of it, they'll probably end up with several adjustments and potentially litigation. So those are the high-level issues we saw with the reduced tax rate. Most of those are policy issues. The technical issues with that we've identified with the bill, there's a couple of them with the special medical subtraction. The bill actually talks about, it ties to IRC Section 213, Paragraph A, and that just talks about the deduction at the federal level. It doesn't actually go into the definition of medical expenses, so we need to delete the A and talk about just the Section 213. Also, when we, this is an error that we don't
I think you're telling us that we've made a drafting error.
Yes, these are technical issues that
Thank you.
Right now. Another one in the special medical subtraction is that there is the limitations, you know, you said up to 100,000 or up to 200,000, and then in the later areas it said exceeds 200,000 or exceeds 100,000, so there's a kind of no man's land for exactly 100,000 or exactly 200,000. I think that's just an 11 p.m. kind of error. So that's it with the special medical, a couple of technical concerns. On the ICDISC piece of the legislation, it also isn't clear whether the new tax applies to all the ICDISCs. There was conversation, and there is some language in the bill that says that the new tax is supposed to apply to only entities that were created or formed before the effective date of this act. But the way it was drafted, it appears that the new tax applies to all ICDISCs, no matter when they were formed, and the deduction only applies to those formed before the effective date of the act, which is kind of incongruent. So we want to look at whether the language should maybe be moved around to make sure that they both apply to discs formed before the effective date of the act. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that was the intent of the bill, was it, as I understood it, was that it applied only to existing IC discs.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to some issues we've discovered with the tobacco tax. There's an error in the distribution formula. There's a piece where it says it needs to be divvied up by a paragraph in there that says from the general fund it shall be distributed in these percentages, but it never technically gets into the general fund to be distributed. So that's kind of a very high-level technical error that we don't really know where to send that money. And I know it was intended to be sent a certain way. I mean, I remember the conversation, so we'll need some clarification on that, some correction.
That's a problem for the treasurer, isn't it?
That's a problem for the Department of Revenue.
For the department, too. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. We are the ones that issue our finance department issues the checks to the six different entities.
Ah, okay.
Right now we're working on implementing the floor tax for the tobacco tax program, as well as the new stamps. We're working on that. So we haven't had a whole lot of time to give much thought to the expiration provisions. You have some provisions in there that talk about that the new stamps will expire as of a certain date, January 31st, 2016. There's some technical issues with the language. We're not 100% sure yet because we haven't, you know, it's 2 years down the road. We're really focused on this other stuff, but we kind of foresee the stamp doesn't bear an indicia of money amounts. It just has a 25 or 20, it's the quantity. And so the stamp that expires would bear an indicia of $1.64, $1.65. So that probably needs to be clarified. We're not really sure what a retailer who has old unaffixed stamps would do. If they expire, do they return them to us? Are they just considered contraband? What do we do with them? So evidently, some of these retailers have stamps that are 20 years old. They've just been paying the floor tax on them, so the value still keeps going up. So I don't know. We might hear from some retailers in the near future. We plan to reach out and talk to them and find out what kind of issues they might have with them.
So would you like the authority to buy them back? What would you like?
We don't know yet. Like I said, we're busy focused on implementing the current floor tax.
They've paid for the stamps.
They have.
Have they?
They have paid for the stamps. They might be unaffixed. They might be affixed to product. Do you want to extend the? I mean, there's a lot of policy questions around that. Do you want to extend the expiration by 6 months, or do you want to not? I mean, we need to investigate that. That's my point here. Is that we're starting to go, wow, there's some maybe issues with that expiration. And so that's that on tobacco. And then on, Paul mentioned this already, the penalty and interest provisions. Generally, when you make a retroactive law like the 2013 tax changes in this bill, you also add a provision that says any UND, any underpayment interest or penalty that's caused solely from this bill will be waived. And you always put an applicability date in there. It says it's only for that tax year. But that applicability date is missing, so right now it would be... For all of the years related to that bill. So I know that wasn't the intent.
That's an easy fix, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's all of the technical issues that we've identified as of yet with that
bill. You will keep looking and keep sending them to Paul.
We
will. And Chris.
Yes.
Yes. Questions?
Thank
you very much. We very much appreciate the work. Just to everyone who's listening to this and who's here, be aware that when this committee considers a complex and difficult bill on pretty much any tax topic, we have discovered it often takes 2, 3, or even 4 iterations before we get the bill to the point where the department, the CPAs, and those affected understand what the bill actually does. And we apologize in advance for that reality, but it is a reality. And we might as well acknowledge it up front. Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would simply comment that trend is perhaps exacerbated in environments in which we are rushing to a conclusion, such as in the special session.
Thank you. I wasn't going to say that, but you took the words out of our mouths. Right. Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Paul, Chris, anything else on this topic? Why don't we go ahead then? We may finish a few minutes early unless you're particularly talkative today. Why don't you talk a little bit about what our plans are for committee bills, and then let's hear from other members about their thoughts on revenue legislation for the 14th session.
Okay, Mr. Chair, as the Chair mentioned, leadership has set a limit of 3 for bill draft requests. So obviously one of them is this cleanup bill, and we've issues that Deanna went through, we have those and probably some more between now and the session. We do, of course, have a deadline for bill draft requests next Tuesday, so we have to get these 3 requests in at that time. We haven't submitted any at this point. So one of them obviously would be the 3601 cleanup. Another one that we typically do, and right now we don't have anything specific, but is a annual reconnect bill would be one that we would
What's
suggest.
What's the relating clause on that?
Well, we can request a relating clause. Normally it's relating to connection to the federal tax code. The reason for doing that, too, would be whatever changes we have that are definitionally related. For example, the change you dealt with during the regular session around the EITC definition. If something like that occurs between now and February, you'd have an avenue to deal with it. Of course, most of the changes that we've seen, the real substantive ones, have been picked up in the Rolling Reconnect. So this wouldn't address those. That policy is in place. But we would suggest or recommend that that you do set aside a bill for reconnect issues. You heard some discussion around the interstate broadcasting apportionment issue. That's a potential one. One of the issues that you had dealt with and set aside in the joint tax credit committee was around the sunset of the manufacturing, the MANI, the manufacturing BATSE. So that's another one that, we've had some discussions around. And those are all kind of, nothing has been requested at this point.
Okay. We've considered a lot of different alternatives. Most of them look, to me at least, as though they were new departures that probably not appropriate to bring up in 14 simply because of the format of the short session. But other committee members may have some thoughts and suggestions about what we ought to be working on in 14, recognizing that limit. Representative Berger.
I keep bringing it up, and every time it gets brought up, it's thrown into a bigger pot, and that was a purposeful marijuana and taxing it. It remains and regulating it, and I know it's bigger than just the revenue issue, but I just see this freight train coming, Mr. Chair, that I'm very concerned that it's going to just what always sounds simple, like dispensaries, doesn't seem to be all that simple either, and so I just keep bringing it up, Mr. Chair, as something that we need to be talking about, whether it's our authority to talk about it in a tax sense, or the bigger committee that was mentioned before that would be combined with judiciary issues, and we've got workplace issues, and I just bring it up again, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. I think the media has made it pretty clear that my view is that we ought to address it, and we ought to get a rule written that does a better job of regulating marijuana than the one we have now, that does a good job of protecting kids, that does a good job of generating some revenue for us, and that does a good job of putting the criminal gangs out of business in the distribution business, and growing in distribution business at least. And just to let you know what I know, there will be a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Friday at 10 o'clock, I think it is, on this general issue. Senator Pozanski is interested in the issue as well, and that could be the avenue to lead to a referral in the February session. For a lot of reasons that have to do with politics inside the legislature, it appears to me as though the chances of getting what you want improve if the bill starts in the Senate. Okay. And I'm sorry that that's the case, but I think it is.
Okay. Well, I just keep bringing it up.
Yep, and I do appreciate that. I suspect that while we may differ on the details, you and I are similarly on similar pages at least. Other issues. So the headline tomorrow is going to read, Revenue Committee talks only about marijuana. any interest in 9/11?
Well, Mr. Chair, for FYI, because committee bills are limited, this issue has been on my plate for a long time. I will be bringing forward legislation from my office, one of my bills on sort of my intention is to start where we ended in the Senate last session. The small session is the appropriate place to bring up what didn't get resolved in the regular session, and this being one of them that's certainly on my plate, I am expending a personal bill on that.
Thank you. And on a different topic, the issue involving franchise fees is likely to come up again, probably starting in the Finance and Revenue Committee, I think. That isn't completely clear yet, but I think that's right. Because we were most of the way through that issue in the 13th session, and so I don't think it requires the kind of time that starting a new issue would. And so in that sense, it's in the same category as the 911 issue. Yeah. Other things? Thank you all for being here this morning. Appreciate the effort on a beautiful sunny day. Let me make one further comment about bills. I should make that comment. The restriction in the rule, as I understand it, is on bill drafting. And I confirmed that yesterday. We are allowed to draft three bills. You're each allowed to draft two. But bill introduction is not restricted. So if you have a bill, if any member has a bill that they bill draft that they would like the committee to introduce, the committee ought to consider those under the normal rule that we normally follow, just so you know. We have been invited to attend the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee meeting tomorrow. The Finance and Revenue Committee will be hearing the revenue estimate at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. There are also other very interesting topics on their agenda tomorrow. The chair has graciously asked the members of this committee to attend that meeting tomorrow morning at 8, so any of you who can come, I will be there. Any of you who can come should, and be prepared to ask difficult and grueling questions of the state economist. Anything else? Thank you all very much. And with that, the committee is adjourned. The committee is adjourned.